We've recently seen Tiananmen Square in Beijing fill with hundreds and thousands of protesters peacefully demonstrating for a more open society. And we've seen that peaceful expression end in a military massacre. Today we step back from the breaking news coming out of China and put the current upheaval into an historical perspective. My guest Orville Schell has been writing about China since 1967 and has made many visits to that country. His last trip ended just after martial law was declared. Schell has written about China for the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, and Rolling Stone. His reports on China for the New Yorker were collected in the book To Get Rich Is Glorious, China in the 80s. His latest book is called Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. I spoke with Schell from station KQED in San Francisco. I asked him, when students say they want democracy, what exactly do they mean?
From the students' perspective, it's very simple. They don't understand big systems. They're not even sure whether, you know, how a government should be structured, whether there should be two-party systems, things of that nature. But when they speak of democracy, I think what they really mean is just more freedom of expression. Basic fundamental human rights, freedom to have their own newspaper, freedom for other newspaper and media outlets to be more independent, freedom of travel, freedom of assembly, kind of very fundamental things. Beyond that, they really never got. And then the soldiers came, and of course, even the sort of rather slender questions of freedom of expression just got sort of crushed in the larger issue of power politics.
So would it be unfair to say that the students ideally would like to change from a communist-run government to a government modeled on the United States, which is, I think, the way a lot of people are interpreting the democracy movement in America?
Well, certainly now I think there's a whole new sentiment just to overturn the whole system. I mean, all of a sudden, in a matter of a week, we've gone from what was a reform movement to a revolution in the minds of the students, whereas before they were asking for these sort of modest demands, and not even for the downfall of the Communist Party. Now they are speaking in terms of sweeping the whole thing away. So that just in this instance, there's been this extraordinary chemical change in the sentiment of dissent in China from piecemeal. There was a real sweetness to the students in the square before martial law was declared. I mean, you'd go out and walking among them, and there was a kind of a wonderful, almost a fair-like atmosphere, a sense of elation, confidence, ebullience. No nastiness, very little cynicism. And this is extraordinary for a country which, over the last year or two, had been sinking into a dark sort of pit of despair and sort of cynical skepticism about everything. Suddenly, the students were animated with hope, with optimism, and they, in turn, I think, infected society at large with the sense of maybe there is hope. Maybe we can, by creating this sort of alternate force of power, namely students demonstrating in the streets, we can coax the government into granting a greater modicum of freedom of expression. But we see what's happened, and it's precisely this very violent counter-reaction which I think has changed the chemistry. It turned what was dissent, above-ground dissent, into rage, and what I think very soon will begin to manifest itself as terrorist acts, sabotage, a kind of any way possible to bring this government down, even if it means bringing the economy down with it.
The student movement didn't come out of nowhere. Can you set a context for us?
Well, what's interesting about the student movement is that it's been boiling along in a way which I think we in the West have often not taken adequate notice of. We were very surprised by what happened. And indeed, you know, the sort of superficial attributes of what has recently happened are surprising. But the fact that something happened is not surprising at all. Intellectuals and students have been very dissatisfied for a long time, and they have been growing bolder and bolder and bolder with each passing month. The students demonstrated, you remember, in the very end of 86, and there was a big crackdown in the beginning of 87. Intellectuals this last winter had begun to circulate petitions demanding that the government release political prisoners, that they grant more and more human rights, freedom of expression. There was a groundswell growing. And I think we in the West often missed its importance and significance because we were so infatuated with the idea of economic reform. And it seemed to us, I think, in a way that since China was becoming more and more like us every day, it must be somehow getting better and better and possibly even more stable. And so we missed, I think, the grave consequences of of this whole element of society, which was becoming so disaffected and had the ability to articulate this disaffection for society at large, which we now see was the case.
Well, you talk about China becoming more and more like us. Do you think that kind of fanned the frustrations of the students, you know, that once the door was open and once more of Western culture came in, that it built a desire for more freedom of expression?
Yes, I mean, when the hardliners speak about spiritual pollution and bourgeois liberalization from the West, they're absolutely right. It is a highly contagious sort of ideological bacterium, the notion of freedom and democracy. And with, you know, 30-odd thousand students in this country now and elsewhere in the Western world, this contagion has spread rampantly in China. And it's curious, you know, we think of our national interest when George Bush goes on television or Henry Kissinger speaking of our national interest. They rarely take into account that, in a way, our main export, and it's a pity we can't hook the balance of payments up to it, is this kind of vision, this dream of American democracy, of American freedom, out of which culture comes, because out of such a free and open society, we have an enormously seductive culture. And indeed, it is this aspect of America which has seized intellectuals and students in China with incredibly powerful force. And what's sort of tragic about it is having really won so conclusively in a kind of a Cold War sense in China, when the students finally did demonstrate, the American government was really had so little to say to them, so little by way of encouragement. And even now, when thousands have been shot in the streets, our government is so standoffish. I mean, here is the success story of the century. Here is the great payoff of the Cold War, if you will. We have a country that whose younger generation, the intelligentsia, are infatuated with the very notions that we purport to have been fighting for all these decades of the Cold War, and we are so reluctant. It's this curious new alliance between the Chinese Communist Party and the Republican Party, and even a few members of the Democratic Party thrown in, who speak of caution and fear of being too emotional right now. Well, it's an amazing thing to be supporting Contras in Nicaragua and to be, you know, evoking the most favored nation clause in the case of Poland when Solidarity rose up in 82, I believe it was, and, you know, we canceled their favorable tariff considerations, but we do virtually nothing in the case of China.
What do you think the president could have done?
Well, I think early on, this is several months ago, particularly when he was there, and when the dissident astrophysicist Fang Liju was denied entrance by Chinese security to Bush's farewell banquet, he should have made a very strong statement, not interfered in their affairs, not threatened to retaliation, but simply to articulate loudly and clearly that what we stand for as Americans is freedom of expression, travel, assembly, and this is not in the spirit of the American dream, if you will, to deny people access to meetings and to deny them the ability to express their views. Instead, Bush just expressed concern and left, and that was about it. And it was at this point, you see, that I think we should have begun to enter this thing, not as an intruder, but simply to state our views. Because these people were turning to us, are turning to us. These are the next generation of the Chinese leadership, not Deng Xiaoping, not Yang Shangkun, Li Peng. These are the people who, if we truly, you know, are looking to the future, we will support, we will help, and we will at least encourage.
My guest is journalist Orville Schell, who's been writing about China since 1967. He recently returned from China. His trip ended just after martial law was declared. By the way, his latest book about China is called Discos and Democracy. Why do you think that it was students that started and led the democracy movement?
Well, students have had a traditionally important role in modern Chinese history in being a kind of a vanguard of new ideas, particularly those ideas which have come in from the outside world. There's been a kind of an innate conservatism in all Chinese governments, the sort of notion of China being central, isolated, self-sufficient, and really fearing and also rejecting various forms of sort of intellectual political contagion from without. But students, of course, travel abroad, they study abroad, they read, they listen to the radio, and lately, of course, in China, they've seen a lot of American films, television, and whatnot. So that they have, since the fall of the last dynasty in 1911, have always been that element of society which has brought new ideas to China. And, of course, they've also come with this sort of traditional mantle of being, well, they are educated. And this has been a sort of a very hallowed position throughout Chinese history, traditionally speaking. And so they are respected as the bearers of learning. And this combination of learning and politics has been what has made all Chinese pay attention when students act. And, of course, it was 1919 and the May 4th movement when students first took to the streets in China in mass protest against the Versailles Treaty, which turned Japanese German concessions over to Japan. And it is this model of workers in the streets, meeting up with workers, launching mass movements against the government, which is so intimidating to all Chinese governments and very intimidating to this one as well.
Well, haven't intellectuals been kind of mistrusted in the past in China? I mean, in one of your books, you quote Mao as saying, the more educated you are, the more reactionary. And then the Cultural Revolution punished intellectuals as well.
Indeed, it did, yes. And I mean, but one could understand Chairman Mao's ambivalence. I mean, he, on the one hand, was quite a brilliant person, educated in his way, but rather self-educated, and he never had been abroad. He'd never been to university. So at the same time, he was a voracious reader and admired intellectuals and was a good poet and a good calligrapher. On the other hand, I think he had the sense of being an outsider and of being in contempt in some measure, held in contempt by real intellectuals, you know, real scholars, because he was a revolutionary, he was a peasant, he spent his life in the hills. And so this created a kind of a precedent in Chinese communist history of deep ambivalence, almost schizophrenia. On the one hand, wanting intellectuals, recognizing that they were respected, needing their imprimatur on the revolution, but on the other hand, being terribly suspicious of them. And Chairman Mao said intellectuals can go either way. They're very, very untrustworthy. So this is what we see acted out now in the most symbolic form. On the one hand, during the last 10 years of reform, Deng Xiaoping has relied on intellectuals, as he had to, for imagination, for technical know-how, to integrate China into the world again. But on the other hand, there's this deep kind of almost sort of peasant reaction against them, as if they're too independent, too dangerous, too much the spreader of subversion and dissension. And we see that part of the sort of schizophrenic equation being acted out now as soldiers are going house to house, searching the entire capital for people who are on the blacklist and indeed anyone else who they may be suspicious of.
Well, you bring up the soldiers. The military, the first time they went into Tiananmen Square, were turned away from the students. The second time they came in, they crushed the students and killed many of them. I know it's hard to generalize, but who is in the military? Can you give us a sense of what kind of men are in the military now in China? From what parts of the society they're drawn?
Yes. Originally, you know, Terry, back 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, the military, the People's Liberation Army, was one of the most highly esteemed positions. It was enormously competitive. Other than being a party member, being a member of the army was considered to be one of the most exalted sort of stations in life. In the last 10 years, however, with reform, where politics has been replaced by wealth as a measure of one's stature, the military has just, the prestige and status has plummeted. No one wants to be in the military because there's no financial rewards for doing so. And so you get the military now filled up with the poorest of the poor, the least educated people from the countryside, for whom the military is a step up and out of rural poverty. Many cases they speak Mandarin poorly. They're not very sophisticated. They don't understand what's going on in the outside world. And so they are kind of insulated and isolated from all of the sort of cosmopolitan influences which are affecting China's cities in such a profound way. But these people, too, have their grievances. I mean, for instance, most soldiers don't even get a salary, or if they do, a salary of no consequence, maybe $5 a month. They don't even have enough money in some cases for an extra suit of clothes. In fact, when I was last in China a few weeks ago, there was a very celebrated case of one soldier who had committed suicide because he felt there was no future for him. And so the soldiers, on the one hand, will obey orders to some degree. This is their want in any country. On the other hand, they are more and more becoming déclassé. They feel very much that they're being left out of this great experiment in reform. So in the respect that they've now been brought in, one has to understand that they could go either way, too, as we've seen, like the intellectuals. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, this crackdown and the ascendancy, again, of this hardline faction does promise them perhaps a bigger station in China's sort of social mosaic.
Well, we've heard about conflicts within the military. Are there clear factions within the military who are taking different sides, some siding with the pro-democracy movement and others with the hardliners in government?
I think there are, but I think they're very murky, very unclear. And I think, you know, the soldiers of the 38th Army who in effect, refused to suppress the democracy movement, it wasn't because so much they believed in democracy. It was, I think, more because they came from location around Peking. They had friends. They knew people. In some cases, the commanders had sons and daughters who were demonstrators. They spoke a common dialect. They had sort of a lot of cultural affinity with the capital. In this case, it really did seem to them, I think, more unthinkable to fire upon the people who they were actually so close to, socially speaking, whereas an army from further out would not have such compunctions. But to say there's political factions, I think it's not so much politics. It's these armies follow their commanders, these old warlords like President Yang Shangkun, who came on the Long March, or Deng Xiaoping. It's a very kind of a personal connection between these people. They've appointed loyal commanders beneath them, and then finally down at the bottom you get these very unsophisticated young peasants who are just take orders. They really don't know much else, and this is what we've seen finally with the 27th Army moving in and machine gunning the students in the square.
Do you think that there's any chance of the army actually turning against the government?
Well, I think there's a very powerful tendency in China, not only now but earlier, towards feudalization, breaking down into a kind of warring states period. I mean, we've seen this economically over the last year or so as decentralization has allowed more and more power to go out to the provinces and big cities. And I think finally, and the country too, you see, is divided up into these military commands. And as the power at the center of the government becomes more and more diffuse, and they're less able to sort of articulate the muscles of the system, whether it's the party or the army, out in these local regions. And I think it's very likely that as we head into this next winter, where there's going to be monumental food shortages. I mean, this country has been paralyzed. The trains have stopped. You know, there's not oil flowing, coal, the factories have stopped. And I think there's going to be a lot of work stoppages, if not outright strikes. I think we're going to see massive disaffection. We saw it last winter. It was very stark. Tremendous sense of cynicism and despair. And I think this government's going to have an awful time this winter, governing. If they had a hard time before this happened, one can imagine with the sort of bankruptcy of their moral credibility as a result of the massacre in Tiananmen Square, plus the economy, which was just, was very delicately balanced even before. Now, I think we'll be in a state of advanced collapse. So I think that we will see power further devolving to the regions. We will see armies becoming more and more centers unto themselves, just as we've seen the economy become more and more centered on regions rather than on Peking.
Well, Deng Xiaoping has been in power since 1977, and I think he was originally seen as a liberalizing force and a force for economic reform. Has he changed a lot? I mean, what happened that now he's the hardliner?
Well, remember, he came to power by extolling the students at Democracy Wall in 1978 and 79, only to crack down ruthlessly afterwards. And some of those students are still in jail, like mm-hmm. Wei Jingsheng, mm-hmm. Very extremely bright and articulate spokesman for what he called at that point China's fifth modernization, democracy. I mean, Deng Xiaoping had said they needed four, agriculture, industry, science, national defense. So, I mean, this was his entrance onto the stage, and I think he bespeaks of a kind of deep schizophrenia that is manifested in society and the body politic as a whole, namely a fascination with reform, a recognition that China needs it to survive, but a kind of an aversion to certain inevitable consequences of reform, namely more democratization, more freedom, more opening up. So on the one hand, they want a capitalist economy, which does apply a kind of a freewheeling, more open society. On the other hand, they keep trying to stamp out these what they call bad influences, you know, bourgeois liberalization, on the other hand. And it is, represents a massive contradiction and I think an incomplete comprehension of the total notion of reform, that reform means values, politics, culture, as well as the economy. And you can't, it's like being a little bit pregnant. You just can't be a little bit pregnant. You can't reform a little bit and open up a little bit, keep out certain things and let other things in. It all comes rushing in. And I think Deng Xiaoping is not sophisticated enough, not cosmopolitan enough to understand the complexities of the way a society changes when the doors are thrown open.
It's in the two largest communist societies now, there's big change happening. In the Soviet Union, it's being organized from the top down through perestroika, Gorbachev's reforms. And in China, we're seeing it happen from the bottom up through the pro-democracy movement, which is being squelched right now. Is it coincidence, do you think, or something larger than that that's responsible for this impulse of change in both of those communist countries at the same time?
Well, you know, I think, curiously enough, both countries, there's a similarity. These reforms tend to start at the top. Leaders say, oh, we better reform, we need to become more wealthy, more prosperous, more powerful. But then, unwittingly, at least from their point of view, the bottom begins to become, you know, inspired, begins to wake up, and then they begin to grab the reforms that this top has sort of approved, and they begin to run with it themselves. And this is the way China began. I mean, Deng Xiaoping began reforming from the top. And slowly, the students, the intellectuals, and now I think even the workers are beginning to wake up, and they say, we want more of this. We don't want to be told what we can have. I mean, Fang Lijie, the great astrophysicist and Chinese dissident, said, you know, democracy isn't something that you wait to be handed from the top. It is yours by birth, and you take it. And this is what's happened in China. And I think we're seeing a similar process in the Soviet Union now, although the economic reforms are much less advanced. We're seeing people in you know, the various Soviet republics rising up, and they want even independence. And in you know, Moscow, they are taking, demanding their freedom. They're not waiting for it to be parceled out by the Communist Party.
The suppression that we're seeing now in China, does that bring to mind the same kinds of tactics that we've seen during previous crackdowns in that country?
Yes, and again, I think it reflects this kind of deep ambivalence towards reform, the schizophrenic nature of these old-time Chinese reformers. On the one hand, they want to loosen up, and on the other hand, when things begin to get a little out of control from their perspective, or people begin to talk back to them to speak up, their reflex reaction is clamped down. And you begin to get all this old rhetoric about counter-revolutionaries and bad elements. And you know, I believe that we're going to see some very serious repression. People will be arrested, and I think they may try to take Peking and make it a model of what happens when people dare stand up, take to the streets, humiliate the leaders, and ask for freedom. They may take some intellectuals out and execute them. Counter-revolutionary is a very, very bad word in China to these old guys. They do not use it unless they are deadly serious that these people are, you know, really enemies. And once labeled an enemy, the history of intellectuals in China has been very, very bleak indeed. And that's why I think at this particular point it's so necessary for other countries such as our own to speak up, to speak out, and to put the Chinese leaders on notice that we are not simply going to construe our relationship with China to be a relationship with them and the leaders, but in fact with the people of China, with the next generation of China's leadership who have dared to stand up now and who will have the most, have taken a tremendous risk in doing so.
We only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering, can the government function without the popular support of the people and with only partial support of the military?
Well, I think not, but I could be surprised. I mean, we look at Poland again. The only way the Communist Party survived there against Solidarity, and using this as a model, was because the Soviet Union was in the wings threatening to march in. China has no army outside which will come in and support the government, and the government is so totally alienated itself now from the people. It is inconceivable to me that it will be able to govern effectively, if at all, in the coming months and years.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about China. We just have a few seconds left. Are there any words you want to add before we conclude?
Well, this period has been just a devastating tragedy for China, and I think, in a way, we are custodians in this country of the future, of the hope of that country, perforce of the 30,000 students who are now here, many of whom can't go back, many of whom have parents, wives, children in China. And I hope that our government will do everything it can. I hope Bush will find the courage to speak out, not to preserve too religiously what he calls this important relationship with this government, which indeed will not be around long, and if it is around long, should not be around long. And I hope this is made very clear at the highest levels in Washington as soon as possible.
Orville Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.